ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. My guest today is Max Stossel, an award-winning poet, filmmaker, and one of the leaders of Time Well Spent, a movement to align technology with our humanity. In a past life, Max was a media strategist with an extensive background in social. He ran social for Budweiser, where he drove a 3,400% increase in average engagement, was trained by Gary Vaynerchuk, and had created social strategies for Dove and several Fortune 100 brands. Max is able to provide a fascinatingly unique perspective on modern content and culture. Max, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, let's give a little bit of background for people who aren't familiar with you and your journey, how you got where you are today, and then we'll dive into our questions.
Sure. So my name is Max Stossel. I'm currently a poet and filmmaker and part of a movement called Time Well Spent. And I initially was exposed to the digital world through social media. I was in college and getting my first job, and they said, hey, you're young, go figure out social. And I was making sales and gathering leads for a company that was having trouble doing so. And all of a sudden, I was aware of the potential. And from there, I did social strategy for Budweiser. What I learned doing that was essentially that two things really work within the Facebook algorithm. One was sort of extreme statements. Budweiser is the best beer, did a lot better than here's how Budweiser is made. And two was putting ideas in front of people that they already believe.
Confirmation bias.
Yeah. These people liked Budweiser. And so showing sexy hero shots and talking about how great Budweiser was a great way to get engagement. And engagement meant more reach. And that was really my first exposure to understanding how small tweaks to something like the Facebook algorithm would have such a grave impact on the stories that we tell on
right.
platforms. And, you know, it's who cares that Budweiser says one thing versus another? Like, that doesn't impact society much. But I started to see news organizations following the same principles of extremes and confirmation bias, and all of us to some extent, putting out messages, telling stories that people are likely to like, or, you know, that are controversial, because that's what works and gets attention and gives us those little hits of dopamine and notifications. But so I did that for a little while. I ended up doing social strategy for Dove and some PepsiCo brands, tried to launch a social video platform called Ocho. We were going to be the Instagram for video. This was before Instagram had video. And
so you were onto something.
We were onto it. Our ideas were good. We couldn't quite do it. But it was doing that that I was designing notification structures for our social media platform, where I was trying to take people out of their world and bring them into mine. Because right. we were told by our investors that if we could keep people for 2 minutes or longer a day, we had a valuable company.
Right.
And right. so that was our goal. And so I was working and trying to, you know, auto-playing videos in the app, because that would work better at keeping people's attention and for longer. And it really wasn't until conversations with Tristan, who's really the CEO of Time Well Spent, or of this movement, where I started to rethink, wait, am I actually creating things for people? Are their goals the same as my goals?
Right.
Because
right.
the answer, to be honest, was no, I wanted their time. And that wasn't the reason they were coming to me. And right. that was really where I first understood that difference and how much power a handful of designers in Silicon Valley have over the thoughts, emotions, and ultimately actions of 2 billion people every day.
Well, it's interesting, because do you believe it is the designers and the algorithms that are feeding this confirmation bias, this extreme cycle? Or is it feeding us what we as humans want, and we just, it turns out, are not deep thinkers, not thoughtful people, that we respond well to extremes and stories that are salacious, that it just creates a bubble of what you already think and believe? You know, if you think about Google, forget the social platforms, but just what comes back in a Google search, because it likes it if people are happy with what they find, right? So they're not necessarily trying to keep you engaged. They're trying to give you what you want.
Right. And so it's interesting the language that we use here of to give us what we want or what makes us happy. And so what's being measured is behavior, right?
Right.
I truly believe we've reached a point where like what we want and what we'll click or what we'll watch are just not necessarily the same thing. Like I think the answer to your question is like, we're both. We are these reptile brain creatures that, well, if you put boobs in the newsfeed, people click boobs. It's like
sad, but true.
Right. That's Outbrain or Taboola. I forget which like has some stat that by far the thumbnail that attracts the most click-through rate is boobs. But does that mean that we as a society want a culture that, you know, that brings boobs to the top? It's worth thinking about. And I'd argue the answer is no. You know, our instinct might be to click that, and our instinct might be to, and you know, confirmation bias is actually a harder problem to solve and step back from because it takes a lot of, you know, artfulness, if you will, to really be able to present an idea to somebody that doesn't reflect their own beliefs that they'll be open to. It's not as simple as just putting it in front of them.
Oh, no, I know. Having debated relatives on Facebook, I think right. This is true.
And so, and in that environment, Facebook is asking you like, oh, here's a comment, here's a little text box and some letters. How do you want to resolve this? But naturally the room that you're in there, I mean, how often have you seen a conflict resolve in a Facebook thread? It's that environment is not a very good one for actually solving problems and actually stepping across the border. I would love to see for Facebook to actually prioritize and make it easier to host discussions, host conversations, help people meet in person to talk about these things, because that's a far more effective medium of working things out than the back and forth text box, which if you look up the backfire effect.
Oh, I will have to look at it. Although, you know, it's interesting that you worked social for Budweiser, and this conversation is making me think of a Heineken, I think it was a social campaign where they took people who were avowedly different sides of social issues and they had them assemble a bar together. They didn't realize that the two of them had different opinions. And then they played for each other the opposing points of view. And there were really harsh differences. And then they said, you know, now you can either leave the room or have a beer together and talk about it. And I thought it was a really clever way to address both the social issues and the brand.
I thought so too. I liked the ad. I think they received some blowback from people of saying, how can you give this other point of view any sort of platform? Like, how can you put them together as though they're equal? But, you know, you can't run from the fact that people believe what they believe.
Yeah, and you can't, I would argue actually that one of the demands today is the authenticity piece. Brands, you know, admittedly, they were putting themselves out there really in a big way. Like Nike recently taking a stand on the take a knee, for instance. If you're more than just a product, if your goal is to be a bigger brand, then to be authentic, you have to have opinions as a brand.
Yeah, and I thought Heineken did that quite well. And how beautiful would it be if, you know, so that's one way of, that seems to be a relatively effective way of helping people who disagree with something kind of get along or see each other's perspectives, having them do an activity together.
Right.
What if someone like a Facebook or some sort of organization that has a lot of attention and data could be, you know, battle testing all of the different ways that are effective of helping people see each other's sides and creating a menu of possibilities based on that goal? If the goal were not, you know, engagement, how do we take as much of your time as possible? But if the goal in a comment box, if what you're really trying to do there is solve a difference or help people understand each other, if all of a sudden you have this menu of options that are different ways in which people could actually resolve that conflict, what a beautiful world that could be.
Absolutely. And so would you say that the time well spent movement really is focusing on ways in which technology can better support humanity, can better make these things happen? Is that right?
Yeah. And so there's been a bit of a shift in that, you know, a lot of what Tristan is working on right now is honestly the existential threat posed here, that when everything is maximizing for attention and for engagement, this has broken news. This is breaking politics. And this is not going to get better. It's not going to get better unless we fundamentally change the way these systems are structured. And so Tristan is really working on that. And time well spent has become more than just design tweaks of how do you fix these sort of apps. But there are certain companies like Facebook, Apple, Google that have tremendous amounts of power to do an incredible amount of good if they were to make some changes,
right?
Design technology for the betterment of humanity. And in short, yes, that is what Time Well Spent is about. But we've started to, over the past year or so, really take a step back and look at this as more than as just design, because this is about the attention economy. This is about this real, you know, crisis that we're in, the biggest social experiment in human history.
What is, not for nothing, but what is the economic model and proposition for Time Well Spent?
Like, how does Time Well Spent make money?
Yes. How do you continue as a going concern?
So right now, it's just been people who care and want to help. There's no financial model here. It's just people who are extremely worried and dissatisfied with the state of things as they are, and often industry insiders getting together and thinking, how can we shift this for the better?
So it's a nonprofit? I mean, officially a nonprofit, like a charitable organization that people can donate to? Or
so I think just become, I think it has just become a nonprofit that you can donate to. Mm-hmm. But as of up to this point, no one has received a salary for Time Well Spent.
Oh, wow. So it's purely sort of a labor of love that has, I mean, obviously huge implications for society. I absolutely agree. I mean, I was looking at some of the videos and things that you had put together, and it was a bit depressing, I have to say. Really good videos, but really depressing, just be aware. And, although, you know, and they made me really think about things. Certainly, oh gosh, I'm trying to think of all the two that really struck me were the dancing panda one, and then the one about the people who shoot up the mass murderers, the public mass murderers,
right?
How to change how people stop making murderers famous. I thought right. That was so well done.
Thank you.
But also really, that's such a standard in news, you know? I mean, if you think of all the promos for local news, it's like, what's that thing in your house that's going to kill you? It's killing you right now, more at 11. And you think, oh, shoot, I better tune in or else I won't know what household appliance is killing me.
Right. It's been the formula for a long time. And just to give your listeners a little more context, I didn't get into this in my bio, but I am a poet and filmmaker, and that I left the technology field to do more of that and to tell stories that matter. The story you're referring to here, Stop Making Murderers Famous. What I saw is, there's a simple change we can make that would be so effective. Because if you look at the research, many of these mass shooters are copycat type killers that see this infamy that is granted by so much news media when you take a gun into a school or a public place and shoot. And they, you know, they're learning from this media and they see it as inspiration, even though that's not obviously the intention of the media. And there seemed to be such a strong case for if we don't give them the fame we seek, and it doesn't mean don't tell the story, but just kind of leave their name and pictures out of these thumbnails and out of the front and center aspect of the news. Wow, you know, we could avoid some of these in the future. It's easy. Who wouldn't want to do that? And so I made a video in support of that. It's quite well done, if I do say so myself. It's made for mobile.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, I think everybody should take a peek, and we'll include a link on the actual podcast page so that people can click on it, or we'll figure out how to do that, because it's really, really good. Fantastic.
Thank you. But yeah, but it is, you know, and this is an age old formula of fear works, right? This is another thing where you say, well, isn't this what we want? Is this what you want? Is that what you want your news to be? Do you want to be clicking and be aware of all the things that are scariest in the world, even if they don't have statistical likelihood to affect your life? Because we'll click on it. I will be afraid and I will click on this thing, but that doesn't actually mean that I want it.
Right. I mean, I think there you also are up against biology to a certain extent. I mean, why do we remember negative events more than we remember positive ones? I mean, that's an evolutionary thing. You had to remember, you know, the lion will eat your brother, or those berries will kill you.
Right.
And that was important for survival. And so we have this baggage as animals that is going to tend towards the negative and tend to notice it and tend to focus on it. And not everybody is going to be able to be supported as a nonprofit doing good deeds. And so in a world where we do need to make a living, where companies do need to make money, how do we embrace technology, embrace the new attention economy, but do it in a responsible way, which still will keep us in business. Because if we're being responsible, but we can't be in business, then that will only further incent people not to do the right thing.
Sure. And that's the challenge here, right? Is that, oh, well, if this works and this is what gets the attention and what gets the ad dollars, then this is what we have to do. And some of the onus is on us as consumers of being so unwilling to pay for digital services that bring us value.
Right.
Because, but I'd like to pose the argument that it's too expensive not to pay. The cost of all of this free is actually far greater than we could imagine. And if we were to really look at the reality of how much one of these news organizations or even Facebook makes on us, you know, per year, I think that's a cost we'd be very willing to pay. And, you know, of course, that affects some people more than others. And how do we make sure that everybody has equal opportunity? And these are questions we should be asking and we should be solving.
Right.
But I think we'd, as a society, be very willing to pay for the beautiful world that could be created if we can step away from tying our time to profits.
Right. I mean, I think you have one of the challenges is sort of the commons problem, right? In game that everybody wants to graze their sheep in the commons, but if we all graze our sheep in the commons, there won't be any commons for the sheep to eat, you know? And so we all have to be willing to take ourselves out of the social swim or to treat it differently. And it's very hard if everybody else is going to keep participating to not participate. You just look at, especially if you think of digital natives, these young people who are growing up, and this is the environment. And they talk about rates of depression being larger because they measure their own existence against these curated lives of their friends and peers. It's not even, they're not comparing themselves even to magazines. That was bad enough. You know, now they're comparing right. themselves to other children.
Right. And to this false portrayal of other children.
Exactly. That it isn't real. This isn't reality. And yet people are beginning to feel that they aren't experiencing something if they can't take a selfie there. They can't be having fun if they can't show somebody else they're having fun. It's like if the tree falls in the woods, except if it's the selfie isn't taken, it doesn't count.
So this has led to arguments with my friends in my own life of like, hey, like, why won't you, you know, share this thing, promoting this event? Like, I very rarely want to share because I think the more often we ask ourselves, really, why am I doing this? The more often we find that we're not actually adding value to the people that we're sharing with. We're creating this, you know, in that moment that they're scrolling, they're either lonely or acting mindlessly or, you know, in a state of boredom or in their underwear at 3 a.m. It's like when they're seeing what we're posting, they're in a kind of, often we're in a vulnerable state. And so how, you know, when we're sharing what we're sharing, are we actually helping or are we contributing to this feeling of depression, of loneliness, whatever it is? But it's led to fights with friends where I just not wanted to contribute, but it's become so much, well, it's just the way it is that it's almost right. changed the status quo in that way. And where I, you know, when I talk to kids about this stuff, one thing that I say to watch out for, and because it is, I think we can all relate, is happening to the pressure is there for lots of us, is like when we're going to the event, doing the thing for the digital persona, going to the event for the photo, hanging out with these people, so we'll be in their pictures.
Right.
It's like the Rain Room is an exhibit that happened in New York and at LACMA, and it just took the most beautiful photo for Instagram. And, you know, Lines Around the Block, one of their most popular exhibits, because it takes such a fantastic photo. You see all these Instagram pictures of people with wings, right? Like those graffiti wings on walls and stuff.
Right.
We're starting to go to places and create things because they take such an incredible photo. At what point has this digital infrastructure taken over our real lives, and how much of that are we okay with?
Right. It's interesting, is how can you embrace and not be sucked in? I mean, even this podcast, right? The first thing I did when we were talking before we got on, I said, oh, and we like to share this on social. I like to believe it has value that we're, you know, exposing people to this new way of thinking, you know, either my interviews with you or other people, that it's things that they can put into practice or put into their use in a meaningful, realistically useful way, that it's not just adding to the noise. But I guess it is adding to the noise.
I have to convince myself of the same thing. you know, it's where my videos live on social too. And this is, I have to, you know, we have to, this is why, and it's why to me, like working with the designers of these platforms and having them be built to optimize not just for engagement, but for things that matter to us is so important, because if the onus is all on us as users and as even creators to be making things that really stand out from the fray and do add value to those to people's lives, that is what I'm trying to do. But in some cases, I'm sure my videos have led people into, you know, YouTube holes for 30 minutes that they didn't want to spend. And I would love for these platforms to be on our teams to help us spend our time and our lives in ways that are meaningful to us.
Right. Right. Two things that I'm interested in your opinion around. You had written an article about Facebook reaction emojis and how this might affect us. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, that was a while ago.
We do our research.
Okay. It's good to go back to, because this is when Facebook first launched emojis. And it was just, you know, at that point, I was right in the heat of my thinking, no one is paying enough attention to how Facebook is choosing to serve what pieces of content that it does to each individual, which is this, you know, machine learning algorithm that is better than we could possibly imagine at serving us relevant, engaging content. And it already was starting to contribute to filter bubbles, contributing to fake news, contributing to like all sorts of things that to me, I was saying like, hey, okay, I get it. Facebook's good. This sharing thing that allows us to share, but we're going too far. Are we thinking about how this is impacting society? And then when I saw emojis released, I just had this gut like, oh God, reaction of, it's one thing to track every moment that you spend on your newsfeed, the amount of time you hover over any piece of content, what you've liked, what you've shared, what other people like you have liked and shared, and how that impacts your profile, what pages you've liked, who your friends are, who friends' profiles you visited. Mm. They already have all of that data. And then to add emotion to it, just like where you could have such a clear, like, oh, this made this person sad, this made this person angry. Anger is outrage is such a powerful emotion that makes people share, that makes people spend more time. So I just, at the time they announced, oh, at this point, everything will be counted as a like. Like, we have no plans at the moment to use this data to within the newsfeed algorithm.
Yeah, right.
But right, that was sort of my feeling.
How too. Quaint.
Right. It's of, oh, okay, this is now, but I can only imagine that this is just fantastic data that will make the content in your news feeds even more engaging. And we need to separate this idea that just because something is engaging means it's good or that we should spend our time on it. We need to hold ourselves to a higher standard of values because the cost is too high not to.
Right, right. Of course, I absolutely agree. And do you have insight into how they may or may not have been using? I mean, I have my own feelings about how it seems to be being used. Do you work with Facebook? Are they open to your input?
I don't personally work with Facebook. You know, I've talked to some people there, but I mean, I don't know how they're using that emotional data. I don't think anyone at Facebook is evil. I don't think that anyone is intentionally doing harm. I just think that this is one of the most advanced algorithms that we have in society. And it's being optimized right now, like for a lot of things, but engagement is one very central piece of what is being optimized. And so when, you know, it's kind of like the brain, you could crack it open, but you still wouldn't, if you cut open my brain, you still wouldn't be able to see my thoughts. Similarly, right. If you like cracked open the algorithm, you wouldn't be able to see exactly what goes there and what goes where. And it's so good at giving us engaging content. I don't think the people at Facebook know exactly how that emotional data would be used. I think this is an, you know, we're afraid of these future runaway algorithms that are going to terminate or kill us.
Right.
But I think we have an example of a couple of runaway algorithms today that have stopped, you know, optimizing for the things we care about, that have gone too far.
What would you say those examples are?
I mean, the Facebook algorithm is the main one. And I think Google, in a certain extent too, Google's trying harder than Facebook to think about.
Well, like with trusted source. So even if when you Google vaccines, the most popular article may be autism, they don't necessarily make that come to the top of the feed because it's not necessarily truthful or trustworthy.
And so they're trying. Right. But when new things happen naturally, and of course, how could it be different? This is a very hard challenge. Like I asked a bunch of friends to Google how many refugees committed crimes in Europe, immigration topic was a hot debate, and I wanted to see what people were getting when they asked that question to the internet. It seems like if you're trying to make a, you know, trying to make an informed opinion about what your stance on immigration is, that seems like a good question to ask the internet. And half of them got essentially the answer of like 56% of Syrian refugees committed severe crimes. The next got 200,000 people committed crime, you know, 200,000 crimes were committed by refugees in Europe, and half of them got those as top results. And the other half got like no crimes have been committed, no serious crimes have been committed by refugees in America. And so the data on what's happened in Europe just isn't available yet. It's too soon, or wasn't when we did that search. But when people ask that question to the internet, they got two very different answers. Honestly, this is a, I don't know how Google should solve this problem. I just know that this is a very hard challenge. And right now, engagement is such an important metric. They're maximizing for something. They're maximizing for whether it's, I don't honestly don't know exactly what they're maximizing and optimizing for that give those different results, but it's something that creates a different output that if we take a step back as society, I think most of us would agree that's not what we want. We don't want to have different versions of fact-based truth, since we go to Google for fact-based answers.
Well, that's actually really interesting. There are two things to add on to that, which is if you use grammatically incorrect search structures, your results are going to be, you tend to get into a different pile of search results, if you will. So those who are not as well educated are being fed a different universe than those who are, which is upsetting to say the least. And also the nature of truth and fact, and that truth, what we accept as truth, can often be actually, go with me here for a little while.
Yeah, no,
like a popularity based, that it was the truth that the world was flat for a great long period of time. And that was the popular opinion, even though then when the truer fact of actually it's round came out, there was a great unhappiness with that because the accepted truth and fact was that it was flat. And so the nature of what is truth and what is fact changes, and we have to be flexible enough to accept that change. And that complicates things even further. I mean, for instance, I was recently, you know, the whole, when you get injured, rice, rest, ice, compression, elevation, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody does that. Well, apparently not. Apparently you're not supposed to anymore. Ice is bad when you injure yourself. But sure, that was the fact.
Look at the health. I mean, fat is bad, you know, like, what is it? Like calories are bad. It's, you go through the
carbs, fat, sugar. Yeah.
True. You know, that truth changes very regularly, but it's funny that you use that, you use the flat earth example, because, and honestly, I haven't looked into, I didn't bother with this flat earth conspiracy, but so in, when you believe something like that now, it's so easy to find 1,000 other people who believe exactly what you believe. So easy to confirm any sort of idea and pour gas. Oh,
well, that my 16-year-old actually went and tried to join the secret society of people who know the world is flat, and it was ludicrous. There was some sort of application, and he just had a hoot doing it. But I was horrified at the whole thing.
And it's so hard in this ecosystem to find truth. There's so much bias. There's so much misinformation. It's so hard. So that when, you know, let's, when a flat earther who just wants to, you know, who just wants proof that it's round. And when you dive into that hole, it's very hard to find, it's very hard to know what to trust. If you're not educated in, for lots of people, it's very hard to know what to trust.
Why is this such an important issue to you?
It's easy to overlook this problem because it seems so daunting and like we're all victims of it. But it's really, I think it's so important. And in many ways, it's lying under every other problem. How could we ever address something like climate change when we can't focus, when our brains are being hijacked, when our ability to communicate is being hijacked? I think it really is just, it's an important point that we can't, it's very difficult to solve the big challenges that we're going to be facing over the next 1 to 10 years without addressing how this thing that has become such an integral part of our lives is designed and how we interact with it, and whether its values are really the same, whether their goals, the goals of technology companies and the goals of our phones, if you will, are the same as our goals.
Right. Well, exactly. So related to all this and these algorithms, though, I was curious about your opinion and how it relates to time well spent as far as data privacy and security. Because that's the sort of back half of it. I just was reading an article and it was this data company and they were saying how great all the data was for marketers and the data owners are selling it to the blah, 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 blah. And the thing that was left out, of course, is these data companies aren't the data owners. They're the data farmers. They're harvesting data, but the data owner is you and me, and we're not being consulted or informed how our data is being used.
Yeah, this is the issue that gets the most talk, you know, the most conversation in this space of, oh, this is unfair to our privacy. Like, I'm not as concerned as most people are about that, just because, like, yeah, I think it's, they're taking a lot of data from us. Most people don't understand the level at which we're being tracked and the implications of big data. And that worries me. It's a smaller part of this conversation in my head, just because to me, it's so much scarier how reality is being portrayed to us. And data is a piece of that. But it's just the idea of, like, oh, is somebody infiltrating is my data being sold to advertisers? Is my data being sold to people I don't want to have it? It's just like, okay, yeah, maybe that's not good. But to me, it's just such a smaller issue than here's how my reality is being distorted and how everyone I know's reality is being distorted by this thing that we get so much of our information from. And when we're not getting our information from it, or the people who we are getting our information from are getting their information from it. To me, the privacy conversation feels like it's getting too much market share of the conversation.
Huh. It's interesting. I sort of see it as a continuum, because the attention leads to purchasing. That's why people want the attention. So it's the rest of the loop.
It's why they want the data too.
They want the data because they want to know, and they want data to understand attention, and then they want attention to form that attention thing, and then they want the data on how you're going to convince you to close that loop and make that purchase and buy that thing. So I see them as sort of related, but I understand your point.
Yeah, they certainly are related. I don't feel that's...
Well, I see your point that people aren't talking as much about the time. And I read that one of the co-founders of the movement uses certain tricks or band-aids for better living in the attention economy. Can you share any of those things?
Sure. And one thing that we've agreed to always say before that we say these tricks is that time well spent is really trying to change the systemic problems here, but we also do understand that people are suffering now. So we want to be able to offer things that are helpful. We're very careful about not wanting to categorize time well spent as the organization that's helping people figure out how to better manage their time on their phones. And it's like, yes, we'll do that too, but we don't want to be branded this way.
Right. Got it.
So one is to allow notifications from people and not machines. Mm-hmm. A lot of your phone is designed very similarly to a slot machine with something called variable rewards, which is when you pull a lever, sometimes you get something exciting and sometimes you don't. So if you think about that, slot machines make more money in the US than theme parks, baseball, and movies combined. And you play with a penny. It's just a play with a penny. It just builds up. It's just one of a very addictive mechanism. And if you think about clicking a red notification on your phone, you're pulling this lever of, ooh, what am I going to get? Every time you scroll on a newsfeed, ooh, what am I going to get? And sometimes it's a text from that person you really care about. Sometimes it's a really exciting video or message. Sometimes it's a job opportunity. And sometimes it's nothing. Similarly, it's that variable reward. But so notifications are one way in which app designers and developers can ping you. That's not on your schedule, but on theirs. And so if you turn off all those notifications and just keep on the ones from real people, apps like WhatsApp, Facebook Messenger, if you choose text and calls, that's one thing that is helpful.
Right.
Another is you put anything that's not a, like, utility, anything like mindless choices, often social media for people, games, things that are addictive for you, putting them on the second page, maybe in a folder, just making them a little bit further away, and training mm-hmm. yourself to scroll down to search for apps instead of just kind of mindlessly scrolling and tapping. Have you ever opened your phone, scrolled through your apps, scrolled back for your apps, and then closed your phone?
Yeah.
that's weird. That's a weird behavior that we're doing. And so just kind of helping it be a little bit less mindless in that way.
So be more conscious of your weirdness. Yes.
Right. And then this is the two most helpful that I've found have been one. So alarm clocks are $8 on Amazon, charging your phone outside of your bedroom. So, you know, first thing in the morning, often our phone is our alarm. We click and then we're hit with all of these notifications. We're behind and we're being sucked into a million different things that we didn't intend to spend our time that way.
Oh, that's really interesting. Huh.
Yeah. And having it outside the bedroom just gives you a chance to start your day the way that you want to start your day. And what I just did, and we don't have this on the website yet, but this has been also the most helpful for me, is if you go into your accessibility settings and display options, you can put on grayscale and turn off all the colors on your phone. And then you can set up an accessibility shortcut also in settings where you can turn it back on. If you tap your home button 3 times, it's on the iPhone, then color comes back. But my default is now that my phone is gray. And just, it's been really helpful for me of just, cause you know, I am certainly not above any of this addiction, any of this exposure to information. It's affecting me too. And this has been one of the most powerful things for me. I'll just look at my phone and it'll be gross and gray and I'll put it down.
That's amazing. I could see absolutely how that would be effective. And one of the things I work on when working on trying to keep people's attention, binging on programs, I'm a horrible person, but is color and thumbnails and things like that. So yeah.
Right. It takes away that.
Takes away my evil ways. Well, we have really quickly run through our time together. I so appreciate that you took the time, and I think what you're doing is really fascinating.
Thanks so much.
I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who helped bring the program to life. First, my friend Rob Naughton, the amazing voice artist who recorded our open. And of course, thanks to my production team over at Microfame Media. And a big thank you to our guest, Max Stossel. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week, right here on Up Next.